in an effort to make it appear as if my sermons have some kind of consistency or theme or planning behind them, we will continue a line of thinking that we started as we thought about idolatry being a way of using religion to manipulate God. And this morning we return to that to explore at its most deep root the idea that it is an insult to God to manipulate Him. It's not just the manipulation of religion, as if we could perform the correct voodoo, then God is somehow obligated to us, but it is the complete mockery of this relationship with God and cuts to the very heart of who we are as God's creation, called to love the Lord our God with all of our heart and all of our soul. And that's what we were made for, this relationship with our Creator. And that leads us to consider another relationship that grows out of that, which is the relationship we have with one another as children of God, as brothers and sisters in Christ. And so we want to give some attention to that this evening. And as we have done in the past, I will open this up at the appropriate time to solicit your input about practical things that you might suggest as we consider what does it mean to be family. What does it mean to call one another brother and sister in a way that means something, actually? And before we actually do that, let's consider a couple of passages that will at least give us some broad strokes of what we might think about. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 is where I'll begin, because Paul seemed to have a very excellent relationship with the Macedonian Christians, those in Philippi, those in Thessalonica. He doesn't really have any words of correction or rebuke, maybe a few minor kinds of things, reading between the lines. But he basically says in the first couple of verses of chapter 4 that they know the things they had been taught and received from Paul, and they are living by these things, walking in them, and they just need to continue to do so to excel still more. And he returns to that idea in verse 9. Now as to the love of the brethren, you have no need for anyone to write you, for you yourselves are taught by God to love one another. And that's exactly what we were saying a moment ago, that the very notion of what it means to love one another grows out of our understanding of love that we've gotten from God. And it's not to say that pagans and people who lived before the time of Christ had no concept of human compassion, could be kind or pleasant to one another. But the real depth of what love is, this utterly selfless and sacrificial suffering serving of other people, completely unrelated to whether anyone deserves it or not, we have learned that from God, and we learn how to practice that same love toward one another. And it is a quite different kind of love than the love practiced in the world, because love, as the world understands it, is objectified. It is dependent upon who the object of that love is, whereas the love that we've been taught of God, it is irrelevant whether that person's lovable or not. It is a choice that is made internally in ourselves, and that's why John will say, no one can say that he loves God and hates his brother. You either possess this love within your heart and are non-discriminate in how you love all people. Doesn't mean that that love will manifest itself in practical ways toward everybody the same way, because it will depend upon what the circumstance and need is of those people. But we will love all people. So we've been taught that. Paul says the Thessalonians had learned that quite well. I don't need to teach you about that. Don't have to write you. You've already learned this. For indeed you do practice it toward all the brethren who are in all Macedonia. But we urge you, brethren, to excel still more. And you can always say that. That's why it's, you know, it's really job security for preachers. You know, you'll never run out of sermon topics. Even if you're in a congregation where you're not always having to get on to people about stuff. You know, you're messing this up. You're doing this wrong. You people are just like Corinth, except worse. You can be wonderful people doing everything just great. But you can always say, and you can do a little bit better. And why is that? Because that's the way relationships are. Relationships are growing organisms. And they're either thriving because they're growing, love is getting deeper, trust is getting deeper, or those relationships are withering away because they're not growing. They can't remain neutral. They can't be stagnant. And so, There are three things in particular he mentions in this context about how they can excel in this love for one another. To make it your ambition to lead a quiet life. And that reminds you of what Paul says in 1 Timothy chapter 2, that we are to pray for our leaders, that they will allow us to lead peaceful and tranquil lives, and what we as men can contribute to a peaceful life, what women can contribute to a peaceful life. Well, we are to lead these quiet lives. Attend to your own business and work with your own hands just as we commanded you, so you will behave properly toward outsiders and not be in any need. Now, I just want to mention this because it is somewhat relevant so we don't misunderstand what Paul's saying to the Thessalonians. Very common, I think, misinterpretation of the Thessalonian letters is that a lot of these Christians had got in their head the Lord was going to return any minute. And so they just quit work and they were putting on their white robes and going standing on some mountain somewhere waiting on the Lord to return. And as long as the Lord didn't return, they were kind of freeloading and sponging off other people, being idle and lazy. Because they were, you know, what's the point of working if the Lord's going to come back right away? I guess that's a plausible way of reading some of the things that Paul says in the Thessalonians. But I think it's much more likely, given what we know about Roman culture, that the real problem is patronage. There was a patronage system that undergirded the entire Roman society. All of culture was stratified by those who were beneath you, those who were above you, and the obligations you had socially and so on to the one that is your patron. I mean, some of these kind of mundane things. For example, on your patron's birthday, you had to go to his house and, in essence, sing him happy birthday. You know, that's just one of the things that's expected of you. When he died, you know, there were certain expectations, certain days you'd go out to his gravesite to honor him and so on. And those are, again, more harmless kinds of things. But there were also some entanglements involved in this. And that's what Paul, I think, is getting to about minding your own business. We need to break free of some of these cultural entanglements, some of which could entangle Christians in idolatrous pagan practices and things like that. And the reason I mention that simply, whether that's the best way of reading Thessalonians or not, is that one could obviously read this passage and say, well, you see, the way we ought to be as God's people is you just mind your own business, you know, and I'll mind my business, you mind your business. And frankly, that's the way a lot of churches are. But that's not what a family is supposed to be. Families don't have secrets. Family members don't say to each other, that's none of your business, you know. That betrays the very essence of what family is. Because in a family, there is this openness, there's this transparency, there is this commitment to one another. We've talked about this in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 25, what may very well be one of the most overlooked principles in the entire New Testament, that if we are going to be God's people and a family of people, we are members one of another, and that means not only we don't lie to each other, that should be a given, but we also speak truth to each other. And it's that willingness to be open, that transparency about things, that there is a sense, if we have true membership with one another, that our business is our business. Your business is my business, you know, that kind of thing, as appropriate to the nature of that relationship. And so this passage addresses this idea of brotherly love, a family kind of love. It is the word we get the name of the city Philadelphia from. It is a word that was used quite rarely in Greek literature, but it always referred to the in-group, you know, those that belong to this particular group. That's your group, that's your family, and then you have those that are the outsiders. Well, the Bible has somewhat redefined this, you know, who is our family, who is my brother, and what are the obligations that stem from that. And that's really what I want us to be thinking about. What are the privileges and blessings of being family together? What benefits do we get out of it? And what obligations and responsibilities are there that are associated with that as well? So be thinking about that. Two other passages I want to look at quickly. Hebrews chapter 13. The Hebrew writer also uses this term here. and give several different instructions that seem to be under this umbrella. Let love of brethren continue. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for by this some have entertained angels without knowing it. And we've talked about the idea of biblical hospitality before. That's not just having somebody over your house for a meal. That's a nice thing to do, and it certainly is consistent with other principles we ought to have toward one another. But true hospitality in the biblical sense is providing for the needs of these strangers, you know, people that are traveling, people that need a place to stay. They need food because of the problems of travel in the ancient world and that kind of thing. And we can still practice hospitality today by those who are in genuine need. Most of the people we have over just to visit with them socially, you know, there's no physical need involved in that. But we shouldn't complain. We don't have as much opportunity. That we live in a prosperous society that's mitigated some of those things. It gives us more free time to focus on emotional or spiritual needs that people have. But this is part of what love for brethren means. Remember the prisoners as though in prison with them, and those who are ill-treated, since you yourselves also are in the body. You see, this clearly is not just a hodgepodge of instructions. He's saying this is what it means to love the brethren. We are all members of this body. And so there are some Christians, we may not know them, they may be strangers to us because they're members of the body of Christ elsewhere, but they come passing through, or those have been imprisoned, probably because of their faithfulness to the Lord. Marriage is to be held in honor among all, and the marriage bed undefiled. For fornicators and adulterers, God will judge. Well, surely the writer has now shifted gears and he's talking about something else altogether. No. You know, the marital relationship, the sexual relationship should be what it ought to be. And that isn't just for married people. All human beings have been created as sexual beings, all to the honor of God, all to be executed in purity of heart. So if people think that just by virtue of getting married, we no longer have to be pure in heart, we no longer have to conduct ourselves properly, that's not what the Bible teaches. And so whether this instruction is to those that are married and how they should conduct themselves, or those that are not married and how they should conduct themselves, that itself is a function of love for one another. Make sure your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you have. For he himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you. Probably the most negated phrase in the entire Bible, with five knots piled up together here, what God will not do for us. We confidently say, the Lord is my helper. I will not be afraid. What will man do to me? You know, Grant led us in the study this morning about the great victory at Ebenezer, where this rock of help, or rock of my helper, was set up. And indeed, the Lord is our true help or helper. And that's the point here in the passage that is quoted. And so, again, something about the love of money that can distract us away from this love of brethren and the relationships that we ought to have. And this lack of contentment, that impacts our relationships that we have with one another, and we need to guard against that. And finally, 1 Peter chapter 1, it's interesting where Peter traces this love of brethren. Of course, he's talked twice already here in chapter 1, the first time, back in verse 3, that we've been born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. And he returns to that now in verse 22 and 23. Since you have, in obedience to the truth, purified your souls into a sincere love of the brethren, fervently love one another from the heart, for you've been born again, not of seed that is perishable, but imperishable, that is through the living and abiding word of God. So God's very character is living and abiding. This has been imbued into his word. And if we are begotten of that word, like being begotten of seed, The implication is we will be living and abiding and partaking of that same quality of God. And then notice how he continues that in chapter 2. Therefore, putting aside all malice and all deceit and hypocrisy and envy and all slander, like newborn babies, long for the pure milk of the word, that by it you may grow in respect to salvation, since you have indeed tasted the kindness of the Lord. And see these relational kind of negative things we need to get rid of and positively live according to that character. In other words, one of the best things that brethren are for us is good practice in how to become more like God. How to put on this living and abiding quality of God. Well, God's given us plenty of people to practice on. And even if they're not very nice, well, hey, guess what? We get more practice is a kind of positive way to look at that. All right, so let's think about this. If we think in terms of blessings and benefits that we get from being family and what may be our obligations of that as well. And it's also something of a psychological test. We'll see what kind of family you come from, you know. I think it's a blessing that you only get beat twice a day. Okay, well, so what comes to mind? The blessings of being family. Okay, a place of belonging. Why is that important? Yeah, it gets to the very fundamental nature of who we are as God's people. We're not made to be alone. We weren't created to be hermits or whatever. You always have those odd members of the family that strange things. A weird uncle, you know, so filling that role tonight. And, you know, you have people that live that way. They've so renounced human interaction. You know, maybe they even try to convince people they're happy or they're happier that way than having to deal with the messy reality of having to deal with people. But all of us were made to belong. And that's why the great commandment is the love of your Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul. And really bound up in that commandment is love your neighbor as yourself. And you can't do that if you don't have any kind of relationship and a sense of connection and belonging together, right? And the Bible talks about this being members one of another. We've already referred to there in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 25. And of course, Romans 12 and 1 Corinthians 12 speak of the body as being individual parts, and no one part can exist separate from the others. We all need one another. There's an interconnectedness to the body. Greg?
Support.
Okay, a support. And we could put a lot of things in this category. Greg mentioned prayer. You know, encouragement, you know, teaching, I guess rebuking, you know, sometimes we don't think of that as a integral part of being a family, but that's pretty critical because everybody can be negative and critical, but only a rebuke that's in the context of a person knows the rebuker actually cares about them and is looking for their good, is there a real likelihood the person responding, you know, properly to that kind of rebuke? Nathan? Okay. So, particularly if there's a financial need of some kind or emotional support, other particular whatever needs that we have for one another, we bear it. Help moving, yeah. Is that on your mind here today? So that's one of the interesting things. You know, a lot of things you just find out by accident what people were up to yesterday morning. It was yesterday morning, wasn't it? Yeah. So helping Martha and Harold move. So Dan and Greg were doing that. And so, you know, it just reminds us that, you know, there's a lot of things people out doing you may not even know unless someone tells you. Or you happen to accidentally, you know, be coming out of a bar and see them, you know. I'm just kidding. Boy, I need help. You know, and that's one of the problems. People just assume everybody's doing nothing like I'm doing nothing. And that's not the case. And I think the people that are out being productive and doing what they ought to do are not the kind of going to be blowing their horn, you know, come strolling in and saying, hey, let me tell you what I was doing yesterday. So whatever the needs are, we're going to, you know, bear those burdens. That's that other side of it. You know, again, if we misread 1 Thessalonians 4, mind your own business. Well, the point there is don't become a burden to others. You know, tend to your affairs. And yet, if for whatever reason we're not capable of bearing our burden, there is that willingness that we have to bear one another's burdens, as Paul addresses in Galatians chapter 6. And even there he makes the distinction between carrying our own load, that's what we strive to do, but to the extent we cannot carry our own load, we share the burden with others. And so we rejoice with those that rejoice and weep with those who weep. Also is another way that Paul puts that. What other blessings are there to being part of a family?
Well, I guess having an opportunity to have an obligation to serve others gives meaning to your life.
Okay. Meaning. Our identity, that's a good way to put that. We get our meaning out of our identity, and that's also related to the belonging, the fact we are created for a relationship, that's who we are. We can only truly be happy when we're fulfilling that role. And so that's, you know, gives us some sense of that. We'll return to another interesting thing Adam said here in a moment, but anything else come to mind? Family does for us. Okay. Well, one word we've not used up here. How about love? As the all-inclusive term is perfectly manifest and demonstrated in Jesus, and then all the particular ways love manifests itself, humility, you know, when you're, you know, part of a healthy, functioning family the way it's supposed to be, the family doesn't parade itself and put you down and make you feel less important. That's not what the family does. The family builds you up and puts you first and is patient with you. And long-suffering and forbearing and forgiving. And all of these are just specific manifestations of what it means to truly love one another. And that kind of ties into the belonging, because unless we truly accept one another, that we have this unconditional love for one another, so that even if I have to rebuke you about something, or you have to rebuke me, it's not a rejection. It's not to say you're better than I am. It's just true love and concern and the sharing of these things together, and within that relationship growing and all of us becoming better. And so the goal of love and all of its many manifestations is growth. And that's really, if you think about it, one of the primary functions of a family is growth. Because a family that does not grow, what happens to it? It ceases to exist, right? And so one aspect of that, at least part of how families grow, is through reproduction. Now, that's something we give practically no thought to today, because whether someone has kids or not, that's not considered a social responsibility. That's just kind of like none of your business again. I have no particular responsibility to society at large or anyone in particular about how many kids I have, except, you know, if you're one of those has too many and you're, you know, pillaging the planet and consuming its resources disproportionately and so on, yeah, you get a lot of grief for having too many. But if you choose not to have any at all, no one is going to say, you're destroying society, right? No one does that. It's culturally acceptable. If you don't want to take the trouble and money and the mess of having kids and all that, no one's going to lose any sleep over that. But, and of course, you know, one or two people making that choice, that's not going to be the end of the world. But we see before our very eyes in some societies in the world right now, negative population growth because people are not having enough children even to replace themselves. And what will eventually happen to society? That society will die. And so we don't often think about it as an inherent function of families, but, you know, now again, you could adopt and replicate yourself that way. We're not stuck on one particular method of reproduction here. But the family does have to replicate itself, and it needs to be growing. Because the fundamental assumption is that this family stands for something, that it has purpose and meaning to it. And its values need to be passed down to the next generation. They are worth preserving. This is our family heirloom that we have that should be treasured, and we want more people to participate in that and to share that, to know about that. And that's really the theological reason to have children or to perpetuate those values that we have and pass them on down. So that becomes a very essential aspect. And of course, spiritually, the way we reproduce is by, you know, converting others. Even, those who may not, be as on board as disciples of Jesus as they ought to be. They need to learn more of what it means to be a disciple of Jesus and more perfectly follow him. So that becomes a pretty essential part of it as well. And it's that constant growth, that constant being nurtured. And the family is the place where we are nurtured. The family was God's schoolroom of relationships. That's where we first learn about relationships. That's where we best learn about relationships. That's where we learn about the most deep and intimate and value of all relationships. There are other relationships like business relationships and so on, other superficial social relationships, and those are important. But those will only function truly if they're built upon a deeper foundation of these other kind of relationships. So a lot of really important things related to this family. And these principles are just as true, or even more true, of a spiritual family of God's people. Anything else you can think of?
This is under the category of support and encouragement. We normally think of encouragement as through our speech, but we're also told to be good role models. So okay. The family, the older siblings need to be good examples to the younger siblings. Ultimately, the parents should be the role models. So in any church, just as in Titus, you know, he's told to tell the older, mainly older women, to behave a certain way. They can be role models.
Okay.
And that people can learn from them.
Right.
And we look to our, you know, older members and more mature members of elders and so forth.
Right.
We learn from them.
Yeah, and I just can't even again think of how many rules of life that I learned from my parents. Not in the form of a verbal instruction. I probably picked up very little in terms of verbal instruction, but a whole lot more in terms of just things I knew were right or wrong based on, you know, who my parents were and how they conducted themselves. And I don't know how many times I've told my kids that, you know, you ever see your mother do that? No, that is probably a bad idea because she's pushing the envelope anyway. No. So, if you don't see that's typical adult behavior, the adults around you see doing that, it's probably ought to question whether it's a good idea or not, right?
This is technically support, but I don't know if we emphasize this difference, but the fact that it's a reciprocal relationship, a lot of these, I think we might tend to think
Okay.
Prayer.
Right. Or really what I sneakily was going for was, as I put them up as blessings, these are things we're going to get out of being part of a family and benefit from and receive. But I think, as Brian has said, when we turn our attention to what are the obligations of family, is there anything I can put on that side of the board that doesn't belong on the other side of the board already? You know, the family's supposed to be a place where we're honest with one another. Well, I have an obligation to be honest, right? And if a family's a place where everybody's accepted unconditionally, then I need to unconditionally accept the other members of my family. If I need to be serving them, you know, if I want to be served, then, you know, if I value that, that's a good thing. If I have need, then, well, I'm going to be doing what I can, right? So it is reciprocal, and that means there really are not two lists at all, but just the one. It's just the tendency of human beings is to focus on benefits and blessings and not so much on responsibilities. We want to receive all of the positive things that come from other people doing things for us, but often we're not as keen to think, well, what is it I need to be doing? And again, I'm glad to say I don't perceive that's a problem here. And hopefully no one is so blind as to say, yeah, I want this, but I'm unwilling to do any of that for anyone else. You know, I want my feet washed, but I'm not about to wash your stinking feet. There probably are some people that brazen. I've heard some Christians say some pretty outrageous things, but I think typically it comes in the form of, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, you know. Since it's a reciprocal thing, as long as I'm getting out of it what I should, I'm willing to put into it an equal amount of effort. And that's the way a lot of marriages kind of negotiate the mediocrity of marriage. I'll give my 50, you give your 50, we'll both call it even. Instead of this Christ-like 100% nothing for me, and the other person has the same attitude and in reciprocating. Yeah, it's not healthy. It's not what it ought to be. There's a challenge there. I mean, you know, you got a family where the husband just decides he's not coming home that day, and he just abandons his family. His wife never sees him again. The kids never see dad again. That's a horrible betrayal of the family. But it doesn't destroy the family, and the family can adapt, and it's not the ideal, but it can impress on. And that's what we do as God's people. You know, sometimes, you know, brothers and sisters in Christ, you know, leave the faith. And you're heartbroken about that. And you do what you can to try to save them, but ultimately, you know, people are free beings and they make their choices. And you press on. But certainly we ought to always keep before us what is the ideal, what we can do, what we should do. But as there are needs that arise, we do need to address those, obviously. So, well, in the few minutes we have left, can you think of some specific things that about how this might manifest itself? If we're really interested in protecting the family, preserving the family, we're keen on truly being a family, what are some specific kinds of things we can do to be more serving, encouraging, supporting, you know, all these kind of big idea kind of things that we've been talking about? Because one thing I'm pretty sure about is there are a lot of families that they say, well, we're a family. But if the father, the mother, at least the adults in the family, have no definitive plan, you know, idea about what we're going to do as a family, how we exist, how we're going to maintain our identity and our togetherness and protect it from the threats that seek to undermine it. And, you know, they're constantly around us. You know, everything that bombards us from society pretty much is aimed at the destruction of the home. So what do you do to protect that? And if you just wishful thinking that somebody's going to start showing good TV programs for your kids or, hey, we'll try this movie and see if it's okay. That more hit or miss approach, I'm sure, is going to, you know, come back and bite us. So can we be more proactive, you know, about those things specifically? So I'm just curious. Any ideas come to mind? David?
Families aren't going to be families magically. There has to be a plan.
Okay.
That everybody's on board with everybody's working.
Okay. Some intentionality to it. That's kind of the idea here, yeah. If you think it's going to happen by accident, just, there does need to be. Yeah, I think there's always going to be things that happen that kind of catch you off guard. You may not be able to predict, you know, exactly. But a great many things we know we can plan for. We can plan for things positively. We can plan contingently how to deal with certain negative things that might come up. Like in an individual's life, as, Stephen alluded to, if, you've got a particular temptation you keep having, you'd be foolish not to take some counsel and say, well, what exactly is it about this temptation? You know, what are the circumstances under which I succumb to it? What can I do different so it's no longer, you know, having such an effect on me? That's the wise thing to do if you're facing a particular chronic problem that just keeps, you know, rearing its head again and again. And so those are, you know, they're common issues and problems that congregations can have that, you know, need to have some idea about what's happening and how to deal with that and, you know, so on and so forth. Adam?